This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Gar Alperitz, the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland and co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative. Gar is author of numerous books, including America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy, which was issued in its second edition in 2011. He has also just published in 2012 a mini-book with Steve Dubb titled, If You Don't Like Capitalism and You Don't Like Socialism, What Do You Want? The Possibility of a Pluralist Commonwealth and a Community-Sustaining Economy. Welcome, Gar.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Would you begin by giving your synopsis of the long-term economic and social trends in the U.S.? Where are we headed?
You know, I think it's a very unusual period. I think we're in a period of stalemate, stagnation, and decay, ongoing stalemate and stagnation. So it's a period that we have never really experienced before. I don't think we're likely to see a big upswing. I don't think we're likely to see a collapse. I think we're likely to see this context of ever-deepening difficulty in the economy, in the environment, in social programs, and along with it, a sense of something's wrong, and a growing pain and a growing wondering about if there's a new direction. And that's an important time in the history of a society when people have an ongoing, longer, deepening sense that something really isn't working. And it's the time when people ask, I think, much more profound questions and begin doing much more profound things in the long haul.
What suggests that we have a systemic problem rather than a more short-term political problem?
The best test of a systemic problem, one that doesn't respond to the normal politics, are the long, long trends, not just what happens in one election or one Congress, but, for instance, over the last 30 years, the top 1% has increased its share of income from about 10% of the income to about 20% of the nation's income. Just 1% has doubled its share over 30 years. Now, that means that the bottom 99% have lost that share steadily over 30 years. Some economists believe, and I think it's pretty close to accurate, that virtually all of the gains, the increase in the economy over the last 30 years, have gone to the top 1%. So that's not a momentary thing. That's deeply embedded in the system. You can see the same thing in terms of climate change. Ongoing, steady production of climate warming gases of one kind or another over long periods, 30% over the last 40 years increase, 3% over the last 2 years. So again, long trends that don't respond to any political change of the kind that we're talking about. You find it in many other areas. The one that people don't notice has to do with liberty in the real sense. So for instance, we always think about it in terms of civil liberties and legal aspects of the law and whether or not your phones are being listened to regularly or if it's hard to get counsel. But the real test of liberty is how many people are deprived of liberty. And there has been a steady increase from about 50 people per 100,000 35 years ago who were in prison. A lot of brown and black people, predominantly. It's now up to 753 per 100,000. Over time, steadily increasing. 8 times as many as any other advanced nation, including Russia. So again, if you look at deep trends rather than the headlines, and the trends are long-term, you know there are deeper structural problems driving this at the level of the system itself. You know, the conclusion is they won't go away unless you alter the system that's producing them.
The mini book you just published in September is titled, If You Don't Like Capitalism and You Don't Like Socialism, What Do You Want? Would you elaborate on why you are asking this question?
Well, if we actually are facing a crisis of the corporate capitalist system, the one we live in, that it isn't reforming, that it isn't going to be like the third quarter of the 20th century, the post-war boom period, then either there is a new direction, a different system, or the trends of decay and income distribution and environmental decay and climate change, they will continue. So I think the pain levels that are increasing are making this a relevant question. I'm a historian and a political economist. When the pain levels continue, in societies, not just the United States, people begin asking different questions and begin organizing over the long haul. So it's a genuine question. It's a genuine intellectual as well as political question. If this system can't produce democracy, equality, liberty, and democracy, meaning how much money is driving campaigns as opposed to citizens, then either there is a new way forward or the trends, loss of liberty, et cetera, will decay. What that means is we have to think through, what do you mean? Because the systems we know about, people are lost in this box that there's only two alternatives, terrible capitalism or terrible communism. But why is that so? Are we restricted to two? And if you actually begin looking around and thinking about how would you really envision a practical approach to building up the elements of what amounts to a different system, that's not beyond human intelligence. And indeed, if you look around the society, there's lots of elements and experiments and projects that all sort of point in a very, very American, decentralized way that is different than the other systems. So we're trying to say, look, let's start thinking about this afresh. We don't have to be stuck in the old categories. We can look forward, and Americans are pragmatists. Let's build something that honors democracy, equality, our American values, and let's get serious about it.
In your view, what type of systemic change needs to take place? What do you see as the underlying features of a more community-sustaining economy?
Well, the starting point, and this is the starting point, not the finishing point, political economic systems largely revolve around who's got the power, and that largely revolves around who's got the wealth. So, for instance, in feudalism, land was the concentrated wealth, and the people who had it, the lords and feudal masters, controlled. In sort of 19th century capitalism, it was small-scale competitive capitalism, largely farmers in this country and small business people. And it's a different society defined by that ownership of wealth. In the state socialist or the communist countries, the state owned the wealth and concentrated the power there. And I come from the progressive side of the spectrum, obviously, but I think the conservatives need to be honored, and they understood that was dangerous. And we need to recognize that state ownership has its own dangers. So if you begin with who owns the wealth, you know, people don't quite realize how concentrated wealth ownership is in the United States. The top 1%, this is really amazing, 1% of Americans own more investment capital, capitalism, than the bottom 95% taken together. That's extraordinary. That's very tiny concentration of wealth and power. And even more interesting is the top 400 people. I mean, you really have to think about that. 400 people, you could get them easily into an auditorium, own more wealth in general. That's including not only investment capital, but houses and cars and other forms of capital, than the bottom 180 million people taken together. 400 have more than the bottom 180 million wealth. So one principle of the next system is, how do we change the ownership of wealth and democratize it, and also do it in a way that doesn't produce state power of the kind that we know has produced such horrible results in the state communist systems. So we've been looking and doing a great deal of research on just what's out there of decentralized, practical forms of decentralizing ownership of wealth, both because we think it's a good idea, but also because the elements begin to build up a mosaic that suggests what might be the emergent next system. Kind of like in a photographer's darkroom, you see emerging ideas come out as the pictures develop, and we're beginning to see that. So for instance, there are some 10,000 worker-owned companies in the United States, and 11 million people working in them. Now, most people don't know that, but that's one form of very democratized, very decentralized ownership. There are 130 million Americans are members of co-ops and credit unions, one person, one vote ownership. And if you look around the society, there are hundreds of land trusts, the neighborhood ownership of land in the common neighborhood form. We could go on, et cetera. There are many, many forms like this that begin to build up a mosaic at the local level, and then begin to suggest some national directions. The New Deal really just took the principles that were developing in the states and localities, and they generalized them and applied them at the national and regional level when the moment came. So if you look at what's happening, the press doesn't cover this. They don't have time or money or interest. But if you actually look what's happening on the ground, there's a huge amount going on which suggests principles of a very decentralized vision, includes small business and high-tech, smaller industry and private industry. But it also has this general point, changing in some way democratizing wealth rather than leaving it to tiny elites and the corporate power. And I think that's the direction that we can begin to sketch out. If we have time, I'd kind of give you a much more detailed picture. But that's the general thing that we're beginning to see, and lots of people involved just under the radar that isn't being covered by the press.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Gar Alperitz, the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland, and author of the books America Beyond Capitalism, and If You Don't Like Capitalism and You Don't Like Socialism, What Do You Want? You mentioned worker ownership of companies. How key is worker ownership to systemic change?
I think worker ownership is a very important principle, and worker not only ownership, but worker control and participation. But it's not the only principle. And indeed, let me mention this. People kind of think of worker ownership as small scale. We're beginning to understand what can be done. In the Basque country of Spain, the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation is 85,000 people involved. It is extremely high tech. It's a very advanced. It's very competitive throughout the global market. And it is in a number of industries, from aerospace to supermarkets and building and construction and medical equipment and high tech. It's not your normal worker co-op. But think about this, and it demonstrates what can be done in this country. The top-to-bottom ratio of pay in 90% of it is 6-1. Now, in most American corporations, it's 250-1, the top executives to the bottom. Now, they have some bigger parts of the Mondragon co-ops, and people are talking a lot about it because it's a good model that people are trying to follow here. In one part of it, much bigger, the ratio does go up to 8-1. As compared with the 250-1 we have commonly here. And they're very, very sophisticated. We know a great deal about this. People who own and work together do better. It's been studied endlessly in the United States when people have participation and ownership and training. All the productivity goes up, profits go up. So there's a very great advantage to having a stake. It's not surprising that people having a stake in what they're doing is important. But it's not the only principle, because although I'm an advocate of worker ownership, worker ownership has to be anchored in a more solid system because, you know, under competitive pressures, worker-owned companies have to pollute if the next guy's polluting because they need to cut costs. So there has to be a larger framework, I think, and indeed there's some very interesting models on the ground that have a broader framework that includes worker ownership but builds a larger community framework as well, and some we might have time to talk about that.
Well, let's do talk about that. And I know you were involved in helping develop the Evergreen Cooperatives in Cleveland, which serves as a model, as a new way of conducting business. Would you like to talk about the cooperative?
Yes, it's very interesting that at least our group, the Democracy Collaborative, and particularly my colleague Ted Howard, have been really working on some principles that we've developed. And this is in a very poor neighborhood of Cleveland, about 40,000 people, largely black. Now, you have to think about this. Average family income, 18,000. It's very poor. 40% unemployment. So it's a very poor neighborhood. But in that neighborhood now, you can find very sophisticated worker-owned companies, and I'll tell you about what they're doing, but they are linked together with a nonprofit corporation. They're not just freestanding. So that they're trying to build the neighborhood, and the worker-owned companies contribute to the nonprofit in order to do community development. And they also have a revolving fund, so they contribute part of their profits to a revolving fund so you can start new worker-owned companies as part of this growing complex in the area. And finally, this is the other feature that makes it much more stable and community building. And this can be done in any city if you can do it in a poor neighborhood of Cleveland. In fact, many other cities are following up. In that area, there are several big hospitals, Case Western Reserve University, the Cleveland Clinic, University Hospital. And they buy $3 billion, with a B, not an M, dollars in goods and services a year. That's leaving aside their salaries and leaving aside construction, just what they buy. Up till recently, none of it from that area. And now they're beginning to focus some of that purchasing power, lots of taxpayer money, Medicare, Medicaid, education funds, to help support this complex growing worker ownership in a community building structure. So let me give you an idea about it. These are not little co-ops. The largest urban greenhouse, partly solar, in the country, the largest, is now one a worker-owned co-op. They produce something like 3 million heads of lettuce a year. Now, up till recently, that's part of Ohio would be importing its lettuce, for instance, from California. Great environmental cost and transportation costs, and it's a ridiculous process. But now they're going to be producing right here in the heart of Cleveland. There's also a solar company, part of the worker-owned complex. And it's online over the next 3 years. It will produce more than double all of the existing solar capacity in the state of Ohio. So these are not little. People think of co-ops as little. That's not the idea. The idea is to really get serious about building something serious. And then there's an industrial scale laundry partly aimed at these hospitals. It's the greenest laundry perhaps in the entire Midwest. It uses about a third of the water and a third of the heat as other laundries in the area. And it's operating throughout that area already. It's very high tech, but also it's in a gold LEED building. So the whole thing is both community building and within it worker ownership, but not just freestanding, and aimed at a stabilizing environment where public dollars in the healthcare and help stabilize and build the whole system. So it's a very interesting model that is being taken up in Atlanta and in Pittsburgh and in the Washington, D.C. area. And they're actually in Amarillo, Texas, doing something. They're applying these principles. There's conversations underway in Chicago and Milwaukee to say we could do something similar. So when you talk about a system, people get very abstract. But think about what I just was talking about. Very concrete worker-owned companies, nonprofit corporation to help the community, using these existing powers to focus, changing the ownership of wealth, worker ownership for the community, using existing powers in a decentralized way to help build the community. That's not capitalism. That's not socialism. It's a different model, but it's a very American, pragmatic, and I think very democratic model.
What conditions have helped promote the success of these cooperatives?
Well, I think what's really happening, and this is happening all over the country, it's this period of ongoing stalemate and stagnation and pain where nothing's working. And, you know, people have been banging their heads against the wall, and the pain levels get worse, and job training doesn't work. You train people for jobs, and there aren't any jobs. You spend $200,000 on average to get a big company to come into the city. $200,000 is the number now per job. And very often they leave after they've gotten their tax credits and so forth. So the actual pain of not being able to use any of the traditional models to get answers, I think that's what's driving the innovation. And that's very powerful, particularly if we're in a period of ongoing stalemate and stagnation. It's forcing people to do interesting, innovative things and to think about the long haul in different ways. And I think that's going to be the ongoing context, which is generating a whole reassessment, both, you know, in the abstract way, where are we going with the system? But also, concretely, what can you do in this community? Why can't we build some of these models? Why don't we roll up our sleeves? Because other things aren't working. So it's a powerful force. It's the force of pain and stagnation that's driving innovation. If we understand it and capture it and build from that premise, the driving force that nothing else is working is a very powerful force if it's turned into positive, creative. The politics of this also can get very interesting. That is to say, moving people politically to do more of this, not only building these models and experiments, but then beginning building a politics around it.
How responsive have political leaders been to this kind of approach?
It's very interesting because at the national level, there's a lot of ideology. But at the local level, what counts is, does it work? Is it practical? So people who would be so-called conservatives at the local level, we find retired businessmen helping build these models as well, helping train people. And also local businesses get more customers. So we kind of find this whole right-wing, left-wing thing disappears if it's practical. If it's practical, could even say we're socializing the means of production in the neighborhood. But that doesn't mean anything. What matters is, are we doing practical work that people understand? And a lot of the ideological stuff you hear at the national level just goes right out the window when you actually talk practically. The city mayor, for instance, looks good when he does this, and it gives him an alternative to bribing the corporations to come in. It helps build the economy. We're seeing some congressmen and senators beginning to get interested, and it rests on practical models. And we're just talking about Cleveland, but they're all over the country. Really building up knowledge and know-how and then building a politics around it, I think, is a very powerful possibility.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Gar Alperovitz, the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland and author of the books America Beyond Capitalism, and If You Don't Like Capitalism and You Don't Like Socialism, What Do You Want? You mentioned efforts in other parts of the country. Would you like to say more about those and how they may be the same or different as what's happening in Cleveland?
The first thing is to realize how much experimentation is going on, for instance. And here's the process of change as well that goes on. Some people know what a land trust is. Well, land trust is, it's a neighborhood ownership of the land. You set up a nonprofit corporation, and it's another way to democratize ownership through land trusts. Well, land trusts are very interesting because they can prevent gentrification and allow you to stabilize housing in a low-income area rather than prices going up, and it's a very powerful tool if you use it correctly. There are also different kinds of land trusts used for conservation purposes, but the urban land trusts are the ones I'm talking about now. 35 years ago, the idea of doing land trusts, which was neighborhood ownership of land for public purposes, seemed crazy to most people. There were two of them that I'm aware of, one in Western Massachusetts and one in Southeast Georgia. Over time, people began to realize it really was a positive way to control gentrification, to build low-income and moderate-income housing, to stabilize neighborhoods. And all of a sudden, over time, you've got all over the country, this form of democratization of ownership is powerful. Washington, D.C. has now got 1,000 units of housing in this. Irvine, California is putting 5,000 units of housing in it. Chicago is doing the same thing. City after city has realized taking over and, if you like, socializing land in a neighborhood form, mini-socializing, I'm using that rhetoric, but it is a change in ownership away from the model private ownership that allows for gentrification and high profits. Because other things aren't working, you're seeing this develop all over the country. So that's another form. There are social enterprises in which people set up companies that essentially are in business only to make profits for social purpose. Now, that was an idea that was really, there were some experiments over 30 years ago, but now you see social enterprises all over the country. There are 4,000 or 5,000 neighborhood corporations that are doing various other forms of business, again, democratizing ownership in the neighborhood. Let me give you a website, by the way, that may be useful to people. www.community-wealth.org. Put the dash in, community-wealth, because there's another one, different subject, community wealth. Community-wealth, the press doesn't cover this. They don't have resources to cover it. We survey what's going on in all these different sectors of worker ownership, community ownership, state ownership. For instance, some people have heard about the Bank of North Dakota, and you're trying to do one here in the state of Washington. We actually had dinner with one of your state representatives, who I hope will become a senator, who's been involved in that last night. Many states, 20 states, are considering legislation to set up a public bank like the one in North Dakota that's been operating for almost 100 years there, again, with broad support. And I think you're going to see more of that. And again, at another level, many states are now looking at single-payer health care. And I think Vermont will shortly come in. California passed it twice, House and Senate, and Schwarzenegger vetoed it, but it will come back. That's another form of democratizing ownership. And I think we're going to see a lot of that, by the way, because the health costs can't be controlled. They're going to just keep going unless we get to single payer. And I think that's going to force people, despite the current stalemates, over time, it's really the only logical answer to control health costs. So I think in many parts of the country, there's pain building up, experimentation, and along with it, a new politics. You know, it isn't only these projects. They're really important. But they begin giving people a set of ideas about a direction. And, you know, an idea whose time has come is a very powerful thing. And I think we're seeing a whole set of ideas that are beginning to build up that can inform the next politics as the pain levels continue and as the old things don't solve problems. There's an interesting poll I recently saw. Very interesting because it was between people age 18 to 25. And actually, there have been three of them. And they're asking, are you more favorable to the words capitalism or socialism? Strikingly, slightly more favor the word socialism. I don't think they're talking about socialism. I don't know what they're talking about, but they certainly are looking for something fresh. And these are the people, you know, 18 to 25, are going to build the next society. So, you know, we wrote this little book, America Beyond Capitalism, or if you don't like capitalism, you don't like socialism, what do you want? It begins to speak to how do we have an American version that does change the ownership of wealth, but does it in a way that's highly democratized and begins to build a politics around that. We'll see. I'm a historian. Over the long haul, big changes as common as grass in world history. Revolutions happen all the time, or evolutions happen all the time. We tend to be lost in thinking things can't be done. But if you look around, the Berlin Wall fell, you know, apartheid fell, all those dictators in Latin America, where did they go? So if you take the longer view, I'm a cautious optimist about the way we could build for the future in systemic change.
Would you say more about the time frame you're thinking of for a switch to a new system?
Again, I see it, and I always urge people to stand back and say, if you're really serious about a systemic change, and if that's what's necessary, You know, it is a process that takes time and hard work. And I sometimes say, don't play this game unless you're willing to throw a few decades of time on the table. My heroes are the civil rights workers. In the 1930s and 40s, you know, when they would shoot you or hang you if you began demanding rights for black people in the South. But they laid the groundwork for what came later. And it's, again, the people in the 20s who laid the groundwork for the New Deal of the 1930s. So I see all of this experimentation as the prehistory, possibly, the prehistory of the next decades of laying groundwork for a transformation that may be possible. Now, it's all good things to do no matter what. It's a helpful thing to do. But if you take the longer view and think about it self-consciously, this kind of activity could become the forming ground both of people and ideas and experience and practice and models that suggest a longer-term direction as the pain levels get worse and worse and people look for real answers. So yes, I'm a historian and a political economist. I see this thing in terms of evolution and time, but also cautiously optimistic about the particular context we're living in, where we may actually have the possibility of building the prehistory and the models and the practice and the experience, and I'm very pragmatic about this, that are the necessary ingredients for a new politics, like the progressive era, the populist era. You know, American history is full of lots of interesting things if you stand back a little. The women's movement came out of nowhere. The civil rights movement came out of nowhere. The anti-war movement. I'm from Wisconsin. I remember Joe McCarthy in the 1950s. This is a parable, I guess. In Wisconsin, McCarthy, you know, dampened everything. Nobody could talk about anything in the 1950s nationally. But in Wisconsin, it was double. It was all worse because he was right there. So if you ask people in the 1950s, can you change anything? They said, obviously, no. I mean, you can't do anything. Don't stick your head up. Joe McCarthy will knock you down. And, of course, if you took that as inevitable, what you missed was the 1960s. Where did it come from? So history is like that. What you see may not be what you get if you look a little deeper. There's rumbling, I think, that may build up. And the important point is to have clarity of ideas and practice and pragmatic experience to actually build the next politics. And that's what I think is happening on the ground if we look at it closely and try to work with it.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The message is really not historical. It's existential. This is stuff you can do. Go to that website, community-wealth. Read books like, you know, America Beyond Capitalism, or if you don't like capitalism, you don't like socialism, what do you want? And there are many other really good books out there. You know, Chairman Mao said that power grows out of the muzzle of a gun. And the American women's movement in the 60s said, no, the way it works is that you get six friends together and you read and you study and you come up with the pragmatic ideas of what you could actually do tomorrow. And then you support each other. And that's where power comes from. That would be the message I would suggest we think about. How do we get doing something in this community, studying and doing something practical, and get on with it? You know, the problem is not general and abstract. It's about what we individually are actually willing to do. So, you know, the message is look in the mirror tomorrow morning, ask yourself, what are you actually willing to do, rather than what's all this abstract kind of rhetoric about? And I think that's where the power comes from.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Gar.
Thank you for having me.
You have just been listening to Gar Alperovitz, the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland, and author of the books America Beyond Capitalism and If You Don't Like Capitalism and You Don't Like Socialism, What Do You Want? The Possibility of a Pluralist Commonwealth and a Community-Sustaining Economy, co-authored with Steve Dubb. For more information, check on the web at americabeyondcapitalism.com. Again, that's americabeyondcapitalism.com. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.